Like, and look, some in some cases we see former athletes that played in the SEC. If I could make any suggestions, I would love to see, just like we get at the men's basketball tournament or baseball, whatever the case may be, even during the SEC championships in football. But I would love to see maybe two or three former standouts from each team represented the day that their schools are there for SEC Media Days, just to add a little bit extra variety. You get to see a little bit of the foundation of where we are with the SEC by, through their eyes. I mean, in some cases we're, unofficially getting that anyway, just so happens with, players happen to be in the building. I mean, like Steve Spurrier, for example. But it had nothing to do with the SEC Media Days per se. If I could make a suggestion, that would be the only thing I'd recommend. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Now you probably, you're gonna have to incentivize that in some cases. I mean, it's not just, snap your fingers and hey, we need three from Georgia, three from Auburn. But
Right.
I think that would be, I mean, I think definitely that that would be great from a media perspective, and it would make sense, to sort of tie everything together. I mean, and the thing is, with some schools, there's just there some schools carry their own weight, and there's a lot going on, a lot to talk about, and then some not as much, and then some know that they have to, they have to do more. So that's why I always like how Derek Mason shows up the day before and buzzes up and down Radio Row and, makes sure that he takes advantage of the platform, because it really is, it's something some of those coaches want to run away and it's just, avoid the enemy, but I think he has a good viewpoint on what it should be.
It sounds like you got a Georgia Bulldog fan in the background too, as we.
Yeah, apparently, yeah, Gus didn't like what I was saying there, so
I guess.
I'm going to a different room.
Here's the thing too. You bring up Derek Mason's name, and I love the fact that he likes getting that message out. He's comfortable doing it, and you could certainly feel that love as far as we had a chance to sit down with all three players that were representing Vanderbilt on Thursday. And you could just sense it through their eyes and their words, how much they love Derek Mason as a man, how much they respect him. And when you've got that going for you and you got that kind of relationship, they're going to work harder and play harder for their coach. In so many ways, they kind of remind me of the way players used to look at Bobby Bowden, for example.
No, that's a great point. And, people sometimes think players coach and it's like, oh, so, a player or a coach who's their buddy. I mean, maybe people think of like Dabo Swinney, who comes off that way sometimes. But for anybody who's ever seen Derek Mason on the practice field, I mean, he absolutely gets after it out there and gets after his guys. I mean, he is a very emotional, vocal, and tough at times coach. Yet he has that to me is always, that's the balance. If you can find it as a coach, of actually pushing your players, getting the most out of them, but still being able to have a real relationship with them and talk and have them feel like you care about them beyond just what they can do for you on the football field. And I think he does that really well. I mean, obviously there are some things at Vanderbilt that there are some disadvantages and some advantages other schools in the SEC have that he's not going to bridge that gap completely. But I think in a lot of ways he does tighten things up with the way he gets his guys to play, and I think in a lot of cases gets guys to overachieve.
The interesting thing about that, everybody assumes it's a disadvantage as far as how tough it is to get into school. You got to be a great student as well as a student athlete. The players are turning that message, because it just seems like, and we've seen this trend in recent years, but the players are utilizing that as a positive, as a sales pitch to future student athletes to Vanderbilt as well. I love that. I mean, they get it, and certainly this senior leadership that Vanderbilt has with the players that were representing them on Thursday, they're looking ahead as well. And if they can do anything to, especially when they're getting drafted next year for the NFL, to be able to wave that Vanderbilt banner, that's exactly what they're doing, and I love that too.
No, I agree. Absolutely. Play that up big time. I mean, Jarrett Pinkney was asked several times, why he came back. I kind of hung out with Jarrett Pinkney on their media day because I was writing about him. But he said it more than once, like, Vanderbilt degree, that's a valuable thing. And, of course, a college degree in general is, but, you know, Mason said it during his time at the podium too, you know, the networking and the power of a Vanderbilt degree is substantial. I mean, it's something to talk about, and he does. He talks about Nashville, he talks about the degree, and he talks about, you know, being able to play at the highest level of college football in the SEC. I mean, those are all great things to sell, and I think he, and like you said, those players do a great job of playing that up. I mean, that's, you know, you talk about life, and I've seen this, you know, in Big Ten country. Northwestern does that too. Said, hey, what degree in this conference would you most value? I mean, the Northwestern degree and all that comes with it, and it's the same thing here. So, yeah, it's definitely something that they use and should use, and hey, you can't use it enough.
Hey, by the way, you mentioned about Derek Mason, you know, coming the day before, not hanging out in his room by himself or whatever. As soon as he gets there, he makes full use of Radio Row, for example. Anybody wants to hear his message before having to actually do it the day he's required to do it. You know, I was thinking out loud, thinking, okay, what if it wasn't mandatory for a head coach of these 14 schools as far as having to be there? You know, just saying, okay, this is going to be the opportunity of, you know, 4 days with a chance to get your message across to all these different stations, all the media upstairs. I don't know how many coaches could you count on one hand that would actually show up. I know Derek Mason would, without even a hesitation. Derek Mason would be there. I don't know I don't know if I would use my thumb and my four fingers on my left hand to have that full number.
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know. The thing is, I think all of those coaches, to an extent, understand the importance. Like, for example, Jeremy Pruitt, as he said out front, he doesn't like doing it. He went 21-minute filibuster to avoid questions. But he also did use that time to, without naming recruits, you know, give some explicit messages to some wide receiver recruits that he's going after, right? And so, I mean, even like Nick Saban, I mean, who, of course, he always says, I love the media, but he doesn't. But I think he also still likes going there and being sort of like the coach spokesman on NCAA issues, right? I mean, he's very good when it gets into something like that, about whether you agree with him or not, giving, you know, thoughtful and answers and being bold in his opinions. It seems like all of those coaches would at least utilize it in some way. I mean, to me, it's like it would be disastrously stupid to not use that recruiting platform, but a lot of them, I bet, would cut it down to, you know, to the bare bones and try to get it to where it's, you know, they're just sort of like talking to, like, you know, the people who work for their website, you know, ideally. And very few of them actually embrace the whole thing, and Derek's one of them.
What, Jeremy Pruitt doesn't like doing those things? I never knew. Never could tell. You know, those are the kind of things.
Yeah,
look, there's
he
a reason.
Still knows you got to recruit with it.
Well, here's the thing, though. You know, there's a reason why you're being paid what you're doing. You're not just being paid to coach a team. I mean, you're the CEO of that football program, correct? And that means, you know, you're the guy. You answer for all of that, and that's a part of your job description. And this is where I kind of get, you know, I guess from the standpoint of now being on the media side of things, it kind of ticks me off, honestly. You know, the fact that if you didn't want or don't like doing it or whatever, then be a coordinator, be an assistant coach. No one's requiring you to be a head coach of a Power 5 conference team. It's those little things to me that really makes a difference. And if you're having to do anything that's a part of your job that you don't like doing, I have a problem with that. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, of course, my answer when you say be a coordinator is I'd rather make $4 million than $750K. You know, I mean, but you're right. I mean, that is, and I don't think you see a lot of coaches who totally abandon that who are successful. Again, now Nick Saban is an example of a guy who has always been prickly with media, can be really disrespectful at times, but still gets the value of it and uses it to his advantage and understands that he's still a spokesperson for the football program, for the athletic department, for the school, at times for the state. I mean, you know, you remember when the tornado hit Tuscaloosa, and
right.
they haven't really stepped forward there. I mean, there's an example of like what you need to do when you have that job. So I do agree, and I think that if we're talking specifically about Pruitt, I think he certainly was not comfortable at first. He definitely doesn't love it. He'll never love it. I think he I take away from this year that he understands he's got to get better at it. So I'm encouraged by that, by even the fact that he brought his quarterback, who he wouldn't let us talk to all last year. And I thought he was better in giving answers on some things. So, you know, I think he's got to understand. I think he does that. Like, he has to reach a certain level of sort of bare minimum participation there. And you wish it would be better. And I wish all these guys would understand that, you know, it is about winning, of course, but also there's a lot of people on your team who aren't going to be in the NFL, who maybe aren't going to be stars, but who have great stories to tell. And to deny the opportunity for them to tell their story and for people to help tell their story, to me, is doing them a disservice. So that's something certainly that I hope that he kind of changes on as we move forward here.
You know, I've never had any issues being around Bobby Knight when he was head coach at Indiana, never had any issues with Nick Saban. But obviously they're out there. All you got to do is just Google and see the bad moments as far as these coaches and their dealings with the media. I mean, it's historic from that standpoint. I was trying to come up with another name or two that's been historically difficult at times over the years, whether it's a former basketball coach, football coach, whatever the case may be. I was having a tough time finding a third person because, to me, Bobby Knight and Nick Saban kind of set themselves apart from anybody else. Can you remember anybody in your dealings with any of these coaches?
Well, first of all, it's funny, and I just saw this when you mentioned Bobby Knight. I mean, so as a student reporter, you know, some of my first press conferences were with both of those guys, Nick Saban and Bobby Knight. You know, so
and you're still a reporter, mate. Imagine that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, you know, you soon find out. Oh, most people actually aren't like that. I'm trying to think of people who are especially difficult. You know, most college basketball, and I think it's different because I think in college basketball, you know, the coaches understand that, like, they really need the media. I mean, they are, when you compare it to football, they struggle to get the same level of attention, the same ratings and all that stuff. So, you know, and it's also, it's just a more open sport. It's not this bunker, you know, we just figured out a play that no one will ever be able to touch or whatever. I mean, it's just a different, it's not like military strategy. I think there's a lot of coaches who, I mean, look, I think Kirby Smart's pretty bad, to be honest with you, at Georgia. I mean, I think he's tough, you know, tough to get him to say much, and he's been pretty tough, I know, in some media dealings. You know, Urban Meyer was no treat, you know, and off the top of the head here. But you're right. I mean, Saban at his peak, and again, he's softened, I think, quite a bit. But you know, when he was really on one, you know, even like with the Dolphins, I mean, that he was about as tough as it got.
Well, I understand, too, and I was getting some information about him in his earlier days. I mean, think about it, too, by the way. We often hear, you know, a lifetime coordinator or assistant coach before finally getting a chance to be a head coach. I didn't realize this until I was preparing for my interview with Nick Saban last week. I just forgot about it. You know, we always think of Nick Saban, you know, it seemed like he went immediately from playing football, being a part of the Bill Belichick tree, to being a successful head coach. He went 18 seasons in between playing to finally getting his first opportunity to be a head coach, and that was with Toledo in 1990. 18 years, and he shared with us, and he's shared it before, about the fact that he never wanted to be a football coach. Just happens the fact that his wife needed one more year of college, and the rest is history. But even with that said, 18 years as an assistant or a coordinator before he finally got his break to be a head coach.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, early days, just sort of like hanging around the Steelers and stuff like that. And then, yeah, of course, you know, really good coordinator at Michigan State in the 80s. And then, of course, he goes on to Houston, and you know, people forget too, it was Belichick Saban together in Cleveland. Ho hum, average staff. You know, they did make the playoffs, I think, one year, but you know, no one was
you know, what was anointing either of them, you know, the greatest coach ever at that point. And now you look at right now, and you can make the argument for both of them at their respective levels. Well, I think it's, I mean, to me, it's no brainer that Saban's the best college coach ever.
You know, you brought up earlier, we were talking about players loving and wanting to play for Derek Mason. That was the biggest lesson that Bill Belichick learned with his first chance and opportunity to be a head coach in the NFL to now with his time with the Patriots. Ian O'Connor brought it up when we visited with him, the author of the book Belichick, and he was talking about the fact that in Cleveland there was that distance between you know, he and the players, and he totally revamped his approach, and that certainly you know, he's not going to be ever the most loving guy in the whole world per se, but he changed that relationship he had with the players, and that certainly has been quite noticeable, obviously, over this time frame with what the Patriots have been able to get accomplished, you know, this century.
He's a real teddy bear, you know. They all seem to love each other up there, but no, you're right. I mean, you know, it's like, it's sort of like he seems to have that good balance of, you know, everybody's a pro here. Do your job. He's not going to be laughing and joking, but like a guy like Mike Vrabel, you know, if you read about back then, Vrabel, he was a crack up in the locker room, and he'd say stuff at team meetings and things like that that probably a lot of guys wouldn't even think to say, but. Belichick loved it in part because, you know, he knew that Vrabel was a guy who knew the entire playbook, knew what everybody on both sides of the ball was supposed to do, and was going to do his job every time, you know. So it's one of those, you know, you have good relationships with people who are as driven as you are to do the job as well as it can be done.
18 days away from our first preseason game for the Titans as they travel to take on Philadelphia. Everybody reports on Thursday, first practice of training camp coming up on Friday morning. You know, we keep saying and asking, all right, what's the biggest storyline, what are we paying attention to? To me, offensive line and the development of Marcus Mariota finally in year five.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there aren't many position battles with this team, which I think typically that's a good thing. I mean, you kind of know who's who on defense. And I think it's also a big storyline, you know, the Harold Landrys of the world, Rashawn Evans, those young guys, can they take big steps in year two? You know, those two picks from last year. But overall, can they find enough off the edge? But yeah, I agree. I mean, offensive line, where is Jack Conklin? You know, of course, they released a PUP today. And,
right.
You know, Conklin's not on it, and Delanie Walker's not on it. And that's great for the Titans. You know, how is Conklin? What kind of shape is he in? And then, of course, right guard. You know, can Nate Davis as a rookie push for that right now? I think it's Kevin Pomfiel is you know, the starts as a one. And Mariota, you know, again, it's going to be the typical, Johnny, it's going to be the typical August, Mariota had a good / bad series and, you know, out of three in the preseason game. What does it mean? You know, I mean, we're just going to have to find out in September. But just to, if he's healthy, running around, it looks like he's throwing the ball well. I mean, that would be the good sign you're looking for as a Titans fan. And then, you know, we'll see how Tannehill looks in these games too. I mean, I don't for a second